Okay, we're here this morning in the case of case number 96-1551, disciplinary counsel versus Judge Sarah Harper. And as a result of the fact that the complainant in this case is a sitting justice of the Supreme Court, the panel has been selected by operation of the governance rule, and it essentially consists of Chief Justice of the Ohio Court of Appeals and the presiding judge or his or her replacement in each of the appellate districts. Because Justice Resnick's spouse, Melvin Resnick, presently is an active judge on the 6th appellate district, and the 6th appellate district has asked that they recuse themselves from participation in this case. And because Judge Sarah Harper presently sits on the 8th District Court of Appeals, the 8th District Court of Appeals has also asked that they recuse themselves in this matter, and their respective motions has been granted by the Chief Justice, by myself in this matter. We, I believe, all are here present. And for purposes of the record, I would ask that the attorneys for the disciplinary counsel and Sarah Harper make their appearances for the record.
Alvin Matthews here on behalf of the Relator of Disciplinary Counsel.
Okay. Stern.
May it please the Court, Jeffrey Stern, disciplinary counsel.
Okay. And for the respondent?
Yes, John Nemeth on behalf of Judge Harper.
Okay.
David Hurd on behalf of the respondent.
Okay. I thought it might be useful, because the judges have not seen the evidence in this case, at least the critical video, which was played during the election, and which is the matter which has brought Judge Harper before us. And so I thought if the trooper could come forward and play the video first for all of the judges, so that we all are on the same page. Cooper?
Are we recording this proceedings, Jim? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
I don't think we have to.
No, I don't think so. I don't think we have to.
Okay.
Is it recorded? It is. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Ohio Supreme Court Board Justice has a problem. It's money. Most of Resnick's money comes from just one place, the plaintiff lawyers who sue. Over $300,000 just from them. This small group of suing lawyers wants Resnick with her liberal rulings to make it easier for them to collect millions in fees. It's time for a change to Judge Sarah Harper. Recommended, endorsed, highly rated, 20 years as a judge, Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, Judge Sarah Harper.
Anybody wish to play? Have it played again? Okay. All right. Okay. We have, despite the Supreme Court rules normally calling for 15 minutes oral argument aside, because of the constitutional issues involved in this disciplinary case, which is not normally implicated in most disciplinary cases. I've specifically authorized each side 30 minutes for oral argument, and you're not required to take that, but just feel that you don't have to be constrained by the normal limits of 15 minutes a side. So with that in mind, and with some attention, if you could, to the question of what is our standard of review before us. Is our standard of review de novo? Is it an appellate perspective? What is our standard of review in this matter? Who is going to argue initially on behalf of Judge Harper?
I am.
All right, Mr. Counsel. Sorry.
Chief Judge Rhodes, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, if that's possible.
All right, you may.
May it please the Court, Mr. Stearns, and Matthews, ladies and gentlemen of the panel. This case has its genesis in the 1994 election. Seat on the Ohio Supreme Court, as you all know. One of the things we know at the outset is that the focus of the proceedings is clearly on the campaign ad that you saw. There was no other allegation of any conduct, any other statements, any other matter that was questioned. spend my time discussing with you. Canon 7B1A and Canon 2A. And I believe if you will spend some time either reviewing the transcript or the briefing materials, that you will see that all the parties, including their expert witness, Mr. Al Bell, and the witnesses that we have presented along with the discussions of people that have lived in this area, all agree that these are the two of the most general of all the canons, because they do not focus on any particular behavior as being mandatory or being prescribed as being prohibited by the canons. Canon 7B1A specifically says that an incumbent judge or candidate for the judicial office should maintain that they would be appropriate to the judicial office. Now, unlike Canon 7C9, which was really the meat of the proceedings when we had our hearing in March of 1996, 7C9 is specific. It does use the word shall, and it does list particular prohibitions what one can or cannot do in a particular campaign. 7C9, like the other canons, was not only recommended by the panel but also by the board to be dismissed. But 7C9 is a fact-intensive or a particular specific canon. 7B1A is vague to the extent that it does not give anyone running any particular campaign any directive as to what, quote, dignity means appropriate to a judicial office. In fact, Mr. Bell, who was their expert witness, testified that dignity is too vague a word to be useful when discussing disciplining someone. Now, in Gumbar Rule 5, Section 6H, which is in our brief, and it's discussed on our first assignment of error, we discuss authority of the hearing panel. But not to be repetitive, but what's important in this case is we were given a due process opportunity to participate in the hearing. And that hearing was before a panel of three members of the Board of Grievance and Discipline. We presented extensive briefing to that panel. We presented evidence to that panel. The panel listened to the evidence, and not just the commercial, because the issue is not how one feels after viewing the commercial, but the issue is whether or not the realtor maintained their burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence that there was conduct here and that the speech in fact falls into the parameters of conduct that is violative of the particular candidate cited. And that was the whole purpose of the hearing, not the gut reaction to the commercial, but whether or not the realtor maintained their burden of proof. Well, in the Gumbar rules, under paragraph H, authority of the hearing panel, it specifically says that at the end of the evidence presented by the realtor, or of all the evidence, a unanimous hearing panel finds that the evidence is insufficient, the panel may order that the complaint or the count be dismissed. It is only if the hearing panel recommends that it be referred to the board for further review that the Board of Grievance and Discipline has the right to act further. In this particular case, if we look to the panel's directive, the panel states on page 8 of the decision, the panel does not believe that the advertisement is representative of the dignity to which judges ought to aspire. However, in the absence of specific misconduct prescribed by the rules, the panel cannot find by clear and convincing evidence that the conduct of Judge Harper in consenting to the hearing of this advertisement rises to the level of a violation of Canon 7B1A. The next sentence is extremely important. The panel goes on and says, the allegations therefore should be dismissed. Now, it is the realtor in this case that are trying to tell us that there really isn't much of a difference between should and shall, and in fact that both words are mandatory origin. Well, it is the panel that is telling the board that agrees and discipline that the allegations should be dismissed. The panel does not use that phrase when discussing the other canons. It uses the phrase that it recommends that the allegations be dismissed. But with regard to 7B1A, we have language of the panel, which is a unanimous panel, telling the board that the allegations should be dismissed.
Counsel, the next subsection I, referral by panel, it says, in the alternative, if the hearing panel determines that findings of fact and recommendations for dismissal should be referred to the board for review and action by the full board, the panel may submit its findings of fact to the board and may recommend dismissal in the same manner as provided in this rule. Isn't that what happened here?
Right, and I think they can recommend dismissal with regard to the other canons that were discussed because they indicate in their panel decision
Mr. Nemeth, I don't see where in the ad they talked about campaign money. You said that $300,000 contributed for campaign money, but my listening to the advertisement and my reading of it says $300,000. It doesn't make clear that the money was given for purposes of campaigning, does it? I mean, as a layperson looking at that ad, does it distinguish between campaign money and personal money?
Well, first of all, it's a 30-second ad, and there's only so many words you can get out in 30 seconds.
Sure.
Secondly, with all due respect, Your Honor, I really do think if you see it, and in fact the text of it is reprinted in our materials, mm-hmm. and we do not disagree with the actual wording of the text, that the text does say that $300,000 was contributed. I don't know if it uses the words exactly as you would like to see them done, but that was not even an issue during the hearing. The focus really of the hearing, in fact, Justice Resnick said it herself, that the problem that she had with it was the implication. And the implication was that one particular justice, her views are tempered by who contributes money in her campaign. Actually, I'm glad that you have the benefit of seeing this ad once again, because I think if you don't have someone telling you that's what their implication or that's what their inference is, if you see that ad, it's apparent as it is to us that the message was that Justice Resnick is heavily supported by people who love her decisions, that they benefit substantially to the tune of maybe millions of dollars in fees, and they want to see her stay in office, and they are supporting her. Now, what Judge Harper was trying to convince the voters was to change from a judge who's liberal, and it's time for a change. And she can say that all she wants, but to make an effective ad, she hits home the idea that not only am I telling you that she's a liberal judge, it's time for a change, but there are lawyers over here that are contributing into her campaigns, only the people that are suing and suing and continuing to sue because they love her liberal rulings and they want to keep her in power.
Counsel, one question. It didn't seem to raise much of an issue below, but assuming that you're correct, that you have demonstrated, or they have failed to demonstrate, or and it would be your point, they had the burden of proving the falsity because this involves the First Amendment, that essentially it was true that Justice Resnick received during her campaign in excess of $300,000 from plaintiff's lawyers, that was found by the panel to be true and by the board to be true. Is that correct?
Yes.
But is she the only justice that has a problem? Says one justice has a problem. Isn't this what brought on campaign finance reform in Ohio? The fact that justices are in fact funded heavily by interest groups who want one particular justice to be on the court or not, and that indeed this is what prompted reform in this area?
Well,
she's not the only justice that has a problem with plaintiff's lawyers contributing large amounts of money to a justice to sit, is it?
Well, I guess it's a matter of opinion, and obviously the opinionary statement is protected, but
in terms of
the amount of money that she received, over $300,000, frankly, I don't know if there are others that have received that amount or more. It may very well be, mm-hmm. but it was certainly...
That wasn't the contest below, apparently. That was not a matter that was disputed below.
Not at all.
Is it your opinion that a candidate's characterization of a justice as being liberal, and if elected would make it easier for plaintiff's lawyers to prevail, is simply at worst an opinion, and at best a statement of fact?
Okay. It's not a statement of fact, it's an opinion. However, I do take issue with the characterization that it would allow or help plaintiff's lawyers prevail below. What she said was she is liberal. And telling or characterizing someone as being liberal, we can all differ as to what liberal is or what conservative is, but that really is protected speech. That is as opinionary as you can get.
Sure.
And the implication, I think, is the same.
Well, you know, isn't your whole problem here not the facts that were presented in the advertisement, because everybody agreed the facts were true? She did get $300,000. But isn't it the manner in which it was presented? That check with Mr. and Mrs. Sue and then cheat them on it? That's an insinuation. And it's not a dignified insinuation. Why couldn't she just come out and say, this justice got $300,000 from plaintiff's lawyers? I'm sure all the politicians from where I come from would have been shocked. That's a lot of money. And I don't think you'd have had to make any inferences or innuendos. But it's the manner of the presentation. In other words, it's typical of politics. You got to get always into that sleaze factor rather than just hitting it head on, go with the sleaze. And isn't that why we're here today?
I don't think so. Because,
okay.
Well, I don't need to.
No, I. No, I.
Hear me out because
I want to hear your opinion.
Because realistically, whether we like it or not, that characterization within the commercial, the graphics of it, that's all part of protected speech. And we're not just dealing with commercial speech like a lawyer's can, like a lawyer's ad to, to solicit clients. We're dealing with core political speech.
Suggesting that all these plaintiffs' lawyers are cheaters, is that within the realm of protected speech?
Well, I really don't see where she said that. Really
well, the check is signed, cheat them good.
Did you read?
Yeah, I could, and I'm my vision is pretty bad, and I'm sitting pretty far away, and I tell you the truth, I expected that to be harder to read than it was. I could read that.
It's interesting because at the hearing, there was no testimony about the word cheat them good being the critical pivotal point. There were no witnesses that came forward as members of the public who said that my opinion of the judiciary has been lowered a notch or two because of that commercial. Not one person, no one from the League of Women Voters, nobody, testified in that regard. And Justice Resnick even said when I cross-examined her that regardless of whether Sue and Sue was used or Cheatham Good, we would still be here. Because she was arguing over the implication. And the implication was that somehow her decisions are reflective of people who contribute funds to her campaigns. And that is why we're here. And that is why they had the burden of proving the truthfulness of those allegations that they brought against my client. Now, the problem is we were being shifted into a posture of defending against the innuendo or the inference. And not only does Yagman, but all the other cases that we studied in our brief speak to that issue, that if you have factual statements, if you make statements that are not opinionary in nature, and if those statements are true, you are not subject to discipline for the mere inferences or innuendos.
Mr. Nemeth, is it your opinion also that the statement Justice Resnick has a problem to wit the source of her funds is an opinionary statement?
Yes. Yes, I do. Because I think especially in, that's a real good question, in light of how campaign contributions was a focal point with, as Judge Brogan pointed out, with many other judges, that is a problem for one person to receive so much money from one's particular special interest.
Well, then it's not an opinion, it's a statement of fact.
What is at least an opinion. It's the statement of fact as to how much money she had.
But,
whether it's
but is not the characterization of it as a problem, a statement of anybody who gets $300,000 from one group of lawyers with special interests has a problem?
I would certainly agree. But at the very least, if you would not, if you would say that I'm slanted because of my bias in this case, I would have to say at the very least it's an opinion. But obviously, my client also believes that it would be a problem. And so do other people. That's one of the reasons why.
And what is the problem that is created by this $300,000 nut from one group of people?
Well, the problem is that if you have rulings that one judge believes are liberal and that we do need a change, the problem is that the judge that still is on the bench receives so much money from this group is not going to continue to support them unless the group felt that those decisions historically have been most helpful for them in pursuing their clients.
Isn't the intended inference that she's beholden to this group of lawyers?
No, it's not. It really isn't.
What is the intention of putting this on the airways unless it is to show that somehow or other this judge is dependent upon and beholden to these plaintiff's lawyers?
Yeah, the intention of putting the commercial on was that one judge has consistently been liberal in her rulings, and there is a need for a change. And she can say that again and again and again, and it's not going to hit home unless she has an effective commercial. And the commercial was that not only am I telling you that her rulings are liberal, but these lawyers over here think so much of her rulings that they are contributing over $300,000. And why? Because they're making millions of dollars.
you, I saw an ad recently in a trustee race where there was a contractor who was contracting with the Board of Trustees, and the advertisement used showed the contracting party handing money under a table, which was interesting, to the trustee. Clearly innuendo, I think pretty strongly indicating that the money under the table is a bribe. Same result. The strength of the innuendo, I take it you would say, makes no difference.
You know,
and that we would then condone that type of activity.
I'm not saying we have to condone it, and I don't know in that case if there was speech or if that was part of the
Well, let's assume we had judicial campaign where that happened. Say there was a representation of a plaintiff's lawyer or characterization handing money under a table to a judge. Does that create a problem?
Those facts are far, far stronger.
Yes, but I'm saying it's still an innuendo.
Well, obviously it's more than an innuendo if there's a factual depiction of handing money to somebody else.
Well, contribution under the table. Do you have a problem with that type of an act?
You know, frankly, that may be protected under First Amendment rights anyway.
Okay.
Counsel, did the record support how much of the contributions made up some suggestion in the briefs suggested it was about half. Was it more than half of the total amount raised in the campaign?
Yeah, that's really a good question. I should know that. But I honestly don't know. It was substantial. It really was. If it wasn't more than half, it was close. It was a substantial amount.
The other thing you've indicated, and I think the cases from the United States Supreme Court certainly indicate that disciplinary rules can't be used in such a way as to chill the First Amendment rights of lawyers. What you're saying is that this is essentially true. It's just that could anyone doubt that the plaintiff's lawyers wanted Justice Resnick elected as opposed to Sarah Harper, and that is essentially true. In dealing with people who run for other types of offices, are you saying that they don't have to be dignified, or does a judge who says something true still have to do so in a dignified way, as opposed to a senator running for office, where he's not constrained by the disciplinary rules of what we would expect from judges? Or do we expect the judges, even when they speak truly about their opponents, shall do so in a dignified manner?
That really, Jim Perlman, is the heart of the problem here, because I think that's why we have Canon 2A, which talks about what a judge should do to maintain the dignity of the office, and they talk about person's conduct. And in order to keep Canon 2A alive, when we talk about conduct, which encompasses not more than just speech, like everything, how you handle yourself, the manner in which you present yourself, we have an aspirational canon that we all should strive for. And I think if you read the panel's decision, you can see that the panel is not condoning necessarily and recommending that another commercial be aired similar to this one.
But now within that connection, your argument seems to be in large part that the core political speech under the First Amendment applies in such a manner here to judicial candidates. It seems that you're paralleling the conduct to every other type of political candidate. Is that correct?
I'm not sure I understand.
Core speech. You're saying the tenets of core speech apply, as I get it, almost equally, if not equally, to judicial candidates for office as well as all other candidates. Then what purpose would the canons serve, if at all, in connection then with political exercises if they are reduced to a gelding status?
Okay.
Whether it's fact-specific or general.
Well, if whether it's fact-specific or general, under 7C9, if it's said and it's false, or if it's said with complete reckless disregard to whether it's true or false, then it's subject to not only a reprimand, but to action for a violation of the canon. Well,
that's essentially the same standard applied to all candidates. Election laws in Ohio, the Election Commission, isn't that a basic fundamental standard there?
That's
would apply to all candidates.
That's true.
Not. Wherein, then, would there be any difference under your approach? Because I see it, what you're saying is to neuter out the canons as they apply to judicial elections with they in effect are qualified.
We're coming really close to that with the Agnew case, although that involved commercial speech with a lawyer. The fact it wasn't even commercial speech. The characterization that the lawyer in Agnew made about a sitting judge was reprehensible. And yet the Supreme Court, the Ninth District Federal District Court of Appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, nevertheless still said, as long as the disciplinary board did not prove that the statements he made were false, it was protected under freedom of speech principles. As a judge, you know, we can't have First Amendment questions unless all of us would not agree that the speech is somewhat offensive or somewhat less than dignified. But the problem is, when you get into Canons 2A and 7B1A, they're so broad as to encompass not only speech, but conduct, but everything. If it's closely scrutinized and it doesn't include speech, there's no problem with it. And if the speech is indeed false or done recklessly, then it can be punishable under 7C9. But to say that you said something and you said it truthfully, but nevertheless you said it in an undignified manner, has a chilling effect on anybody that's going to speak. Because you, in a campaign against me, may view something that I said as being somewhat harshly and undignified. And if I'm smart, I'm going to then probably say, since I don't have a chance of beating this incumbent judge, I'd rather just opt out to be silent. Because then I've got a much better chance of not being reprimanded. So it's the protection under First Amendment freedom of speech that requires courts to look at these particular opinions far more closely when they are being applied strictly to speech. And in this case, we're not talking about commercial speech. We're talking about core political speech. The whole idea of being able to interchange ideas in an election contest about your opponent or why you feel you're a better suited candidate is a fundamental tenet of a democracy.
Would you concede that the state has a compelling interest in maintaining respect for the courts and the judiciary?
Yeah.
And that compelling interest, and that as long as they draw their rules to narrowly tailor that interest, it would survive constitutional challenge?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's the phrase, that it has to be narrowly tailored, either as it's written or as it is applied. And certainly these canons can survive, but as they are applied, they can't. And that's why the panel, I think, was intuitive when they said that there is no specific conduct that the realtors prove that's violative of these particular canons. And I think if you look to the decision by the full board, it is completely result-oriented because it talks about innuendos and it talks about inferences. It does not talk about specific facts. In fact, it's somewhat puzzling for us because here we are looking at this, and yet we don't see where the board sitting as a whole came up with any other aspect or argument as to why any of this is violative of the canons, except the fact that they said that they felt differently about it, which means that it wouldn't go through the whole hearing process for, and what about the due process requirement that the realtor has the burden of proof to show that that there was indeed a violation. One last point, because I would like to reserve some time. We have asked the board for the names of all the people who sat in the board on the vote that, in effect, did not adopt the panel's recommendations, but saw fit to find a violation in these two particular instances. And we were told that we would be given the names of the people that abstained, if you will, and there are four names or five names that are listed in this particular decision. We have consistently asked for the names of the people. For example, there's an attorney in Columbus, his name is Dale Perdue, and Dale Perdue may be a fine attorney, but he is appointed to the Board of Grievance and Discipline by Justice Resnick, and members of his law firm, all three partners, have contributed substantial sums of money to her campaign. And if he was sitting on this particular board when this vote was taken, we once again find that it's a problem for us because of conflict.
He's presently the president of the High Trial Lawyers Association?
He is. And we know he was on the board as of November of 1995. This vote was taken in July of 96. And we were told that the best we're ever going to do is to go find our own list of people who are on the board and to subtract the names of these five people because they're the five that abstained from the vote.
Okay, counsel, you want to reserve a few minutes? Okay. Counsel.
May it please the court,
maintain that this court should adopt the amended findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations of the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline, recommending that respondent be publicly reprimanded. In support of this, we set forth three part arguments. First of all, the canon in question, canon 2A and canon 7B1A, were properly applied and did not offend the First Amendment because these canons are properly tailored to promote a compelling interest in Ohio to maintain the reputation of the judiciary and to make sure that candidates conduct themselves in a dignified manner.
Counsel, there's a case in Cincinnati some years ago. It's City of Cincinnati versus Coates, where there was a city ordinance that said that they made it unlawful for three or more persons to congregate together in such a manner as to being annoying to others. Presumably gave to police officers in the City of Cincinnati the carte blanche authority to arrest anyone that he found annoying. And during the late 60s, that certainly suggested that police officers might well act as Officer Grupke and arrest people that he or she found annoying. The United States Supreme Court specifically found that language of that ordinance, using the term annoying to others, to be unconstitutionally vague and violative of the First Amendment. Not only because it could not warn the individual as to what conduct that he should, keep his conduct accordingly to this language annoying, how he should conform his actions to the law, as well as it made it difficult for any police officer to know who he should or should not arrest. How is the word dignified or dignity any better than the term annoying? What is dignified to one person may not be dignified to another. And how does one conform one's actions to the law, and how does one enforce such a vague phrase?
Obviously, the statute to which you refer is vague because it does not let the offender know that the conduct is wrong. It's interesting because this word dignity, in the context of what the canon says, is very narrowly tailored. I mean, you can pull out the word dignity and suggest that might perhaps be a word that the judges may not be able to comport their conduct to. However, if you look at the wording of the canon, it indicates that a judge should maintain conduct that with dignity appropriate to the judicial office and so forth. So when we're looking at this particular canon,
can I ask a question? Can, if the rules are promulgated to instill confidence in the judiciary, can the rules require a candidate or a judge to act in such a way that prohibits them from exercising their right to express horrible
opinions?
Can the rules go that far?
Yes, they can, because there's a compelling state interest. Judges are different. Judicial races are different because judges make decisions, and judges have to be impartial. Judges have to have integrity. They cannot be beholden to special interests. And this particular commercial says quite the opposite. It says that a particular judge, essentially, has a problem, and Judge Wolf's question is right on point in that regard. A judge has a problem with money because she receives money from a particular group. They would like to suggest that they were saying, well, these people only support her because of her ruling. That's not what they're saying, though, because supporting a candidate because you believe what they believe, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's why people in the United States vote for whom they wish to support, because they agree with them. But the problem arises if their
president has received $300,000 from plaintiff's lawyers?
That would be totally true, a totally true statement in the context of what was proven at the hearing. But we have to remind this court that that was the only true thing about this commercial.
But would that, if just as Mr. Nemeth said, providing information that this judge gets lots of money from people who like your opinions, period, and not characterizing it as a problem, would that have been okay?
That would have been okay, Mark, Your Honor. And the reason that that would have been okay is because it was just giving information. It was not harmful to the judiciary. And that's where the state's compelling interest comes in. If the conduct is harmful to the judiciary, if it denigrates the judiciary in the public eye, if it says that a justice or a court is beholden to special interests, then that's where the problem arises.
Did most of her money come from the Trial Lawyers Association?
I think the facts show that a substantial portion, we didn't assert in our brief that about half of it came from there. I think the respondent may have asserted that in her brief, and we didn't dispute the money because that
you
was
don't
not
dispute
the issue.
That most of her campaign money came from the Trial Lawyers Association or people affiliated with plaintiff's lawyers.
We don't know, so we don't dispute it, Your Honor. And that's not the issue here. They would like the issue to be Canon 7C9 because Canon 7C9 requires a very high standard of falsity that pertains to every type of speech by every citizen in the United States, by every other candidate running in any other type of race. But we want to respectfully suggest that judicial campaigns are different.
Would she have a problem if all her money came from the Trial Lawyers Association? Would she have a problem in public perception that all her money came from one interest group?
That's a good question, Your Honor. Public perception, there's no doubt that the public, or certain members of the public, may perceive that campaign contributions present a problem.
But why isn't that a fair characterization by one political candidate of another political candidate that they have a problem from accepting too much money from certain lawyers?
Because of the way that it is done, Your Honor, it goes beyond the bounds of appropriate speech because it denigrates the judiciary. It goes further than saying that there is a problem in a vague sense. It goes further and it says that she's got a problem and they rule for her because, and she rules for them because they give her money. So it goes far beyond what one would say if they simply said that she's got a problem in general. And then you get to the visual aspect of the ad, the cheat em good, the sue and sue, Resnick's money, and all of that.
Well, what about hyperbole? You're certainly familiar with the case involving Larry Flint and the Reverend Falwell. The Supreme Court said that hyperbole is protected, is not fact, it's an exaggeration, and that it's often used in political discourse. And the court said that in that case that Jerry Falwell could not recover from Larry Flint because he was obviously exaggerating for purposes of making a point. Why isn't that simply clearly an exaggeration? I mean, no one would believe that there's a firm called Sue and Sue, but just that characterizes plaintiff's lawyers who bring litigation.
Because once again, Your Honor, respectfully, we're talking about the conduct that pertains to Mr. Flint, who is a citizen in these United States as opposed to a judge. Okay. And that's where the difference, therein lies the difference. Falsity is not the sole issue in this case. A judge cannot, or a judicial candidate cannot, openly denigrate an opponent.
What if the Fourth Estate doesn't perform its task of finding out that, in fact, $350,000 or $300,000 was given to a particular candidate? As long as we have elected judges in this state, as opposed to merit selection, why shouldn't the person who has the keenest interest in the outcome, the candidate themselves, bring that matter to the attention of the public? Do you know if the dispatch or whoever is not bringing that information to the public's mind, why shouldn't the candidate have a right to bring that? Isn't that the core value of First Amendment speech?
And that goes to Judge Wolf's question as to whether stating that she received $300, whether that would have violated the code. It would not have violated the code.
Okay. So it's just the manner in which, as Judge O'Neill said, the manner in which it was said. The tone of this article was undignified and shed poorly on the profession and on the court.
It was irresponsible, it was harmful to the judiciary, harmful to the public's respect for the judiciary. And those are the standards that we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with standards that apply to other campaigns. Now I want to talk about this issue of shall versus should. They made much ado about Canon 7C9 containing the word shall. If you look at the history of the Code of Judicial Conduct as adopted by the Supreme Court, it is based on the ABA Model Code. The ABA Model Code was amended in 1990. The only canon